Okay, gentlemen and ladies, this is AC2GS. My name is Roy. I am net control operator for this edition of the Limark Technical Net. We're here every Sunday night at 8 o'clock, and we go on hopefully about until 11 p.m. And I hope there's enough people out there with enough questions to keep things moving. As I always do, I like to remind people, if you have any questions that you would like to ask me, if you have any mailbag questions of a technical nature, if you have any topics of a science nature, or if you want to have a full comment about a website or a story that you read about space, the email address that you can get us is at mailbag@ac2gs.com. Again, mailbag@ac2gs.com. Everything that I talk about pretty much I will offer links to on my link page. That is roy.ac2gs.com. Again, roy.ac2gs.com is the link page. There is a chat room. You can get to it by typing in chat.ac2gs.com. And of course, hopefully, I am offering a stream audio of this technical net. Hopefully it's not being distorted too much. I'm using some emergency equipment tonight. That can be found at technet.ac2gs.com, and that'll give you the audio stream. And as always, remember that Mike, AC2NJI, supplies archives of this and the past 10 plus years of the technical net. And his location is amateurradio.tv. Again, amateurradio.tv. So let me drop for a second, and then I'll ask if anyone has any questions or topics of a technical nature for tonight. When we've exhausted those, unfortunately, I have no mailbag questions. So we'll get into the science talk and probably discuss the virus to one degree or another. But nevertheless, if anyone has any technical questions, this is a TechNet show, please give me your first name and your call sign.
This is KAC2LR.
AC2LR recognized. Anyone else want to put their name on the list tonight?
Whiskey 2 Bravo Zulu.
Okay, Whiskey 2 Bravo Zulu. Rich, you're on the list. Anyone else want to ask any technical questions or any topics for the TechNet tonight? Please give me your first name and your call sign. Okay, very well. Hopefully later on there'll be some more questions. K, AC2LR, what's your question for tonight, K?
Hey, Roy. It's so great to hear a live voice. I was making a net lately on Sundays, and it was just so great to still be connecting across the airwaves, everyone. I just tried to look at the chat at ac2gs.com, and I did not even find a website, so I'm wondering if I'm doing it wrong. Thank you, AC2LR.
Okay, hopefully the alias is working. I will pause my audio stream for just a little bit of time and type in chat.ac2gs.com and see if it comes up on my web browser. Okay, I typed in chat.ac2gs.com and I got the right page.
Me too. I did a chat at AC2GS. Now I have chat dot AC2GS. I see it and I'm in. Thank you, Roy.
Okay, very good, Kay. Did you have any other questions for tonight?
Not yet. I may as I continue listening or when Paul gets to the statement.
Okay, very good, Kay. Rich, W2BZ, you were next. Rich, are you out there? W2BZ, I see you on the echo link, but I think that you were coming across on RF, so if you hear me, you're...
Paul, as a Whiskey 2 Bravo. I just have to set something up. I'm playing with my receiver versus Echo Link, and I could ask the question now. I have, it's full quieting coming in on my SDR receiving. It's the RSP1A, SDA RSP1A. But I also have a 60-cycle hum with it, which I don't get on the low bands with the same setup. And I'm just wondering if you might know, have an idea, or anybody, what could be causing that. Go ahead.
Okay, Rich, my gut sense, and I might be completely wrong, is that you're probably not picking up a 60-cycle hum. You're probably picking up the, quote, subaudible, end quote, PL tone. Do you think that's a possibility?
How is it with the timing of Echo Link? That is a possibility. I guess that would be, I've never in this software, which is SDR console, or SDR Sharp, fiddled or even saw a setting that dealt with the PL. But that could very well be, and I will, during the TechNet, I'll click around to see if there is, in fact, a PL setting that could be turned on or off or manipulated in any way. Back to you.
Well, lots of luck with that, Rich. I have not found too much software that has repeaters in mind. And it's very rare that it actually does have a built-in notch filter. You have to usually apply an external one. One way to really test whether it's a background hum or a PL tone is to try and listen to someone operating simplex on something like 520. Where they're not injecting a subaudible tone into it and see if there's a difference in those cases. I think that that's it, because I have noticed the same hum when using software-defined radios. Again, because they're not terribly well designed for repeaters in mind. They're primarily designed for HF and simplex UHF and VHF.
Could very well be. During the week, I'll ask somebody to go on simplex, somebody fairly close to me, to see if that might be it. It does sound logical that, and I just picked 60 cycle hum sort of out of the air because it's a low frequency hum, and in that, general vicinity of sounding like 60 cycles. So I'll look into that, and also during the net, like I said, see if there is any PL configurable switch or something where I would put in 136.5 or whatever. So I'll take a look at that. Thanks, Roy. Back to net.
Okay, very good, Rich. Well, it's now 8:10. Does anyone else have any questions or topics for the technical net tonight? Please give me your first name and your call sign.
ECQLR.
John. We're in Cape Cod, Florida. I have a query. Back to you, Roy.
Okay, first K and then Florida. K, what's your question or your comment?
Oh, never mind. I'll defer to Florida.
Okay, Florida, the radio is yours. Can you give me your first name and your call sign again?
Okay, Roger, the handle is John Spirit, Ocean Hotel, November. The call is King Bravo 2, Alpha Golf Bar. My question was, I've been off the air for a little bit due to, what you call it, for the echolalia. I don't know how to put it. But anyway, Dick, I haven't heard Dick on. Could you elaborate, is he still on the air, or is he okay, or... I mean, I've been listening to him since 1988, over.
Yes, indeed. I get this question regularly. Dick is okay. He has some chronic health issues that are complicating his life and distracting him, and he thought that rather than, you know, not give this technical net the 110% that he always gave it, that he would step away for a while and care to his own situation and his problems, and we hope that he'll be back soon. As I've mentioned a few times, I don't see myself as replacing him. I see myself as keeping the chair warm for him.
Okay, Roy. Well, you're doing a great job, and don't take second fiddle. You're doing a great job too. And thank you for keep running the net. There's a lot of interesting topics that's been transmitted over the years. I'm sure a lot of people got knowledge and was able to solve their problem. I know I put on a technical question one time about I was running the wrong wire, and he straightened me out with that, and it's working fine. So, all right. Anyway, if you talk to Dick, just tell him the guy from Florida is wishing him the best. Speedy recovery, whatever that may be ailing him. And, boy, you take lead there and do a great job as always. I know you will. And thank you for taking my question. King Bravo 2, Alpha Alpha 5.
Well, thank you very much, John. I will pass on the message to Dick. And be safe and be well. And continue to come back, and we'll continue to try and help you out if we can. Does anyone else have any questions of a technical nature tonight? Please, if you do, give me your first name and your call sign.
Scott, Kilo Delta 2, Lima Alpha Victor.
Yes, what's your first name?
Scott, Kilo Delta 2, Lima Alpha Victor. I just want to say it's not really a technical question. I'm kind of new to ham radio, so I'm just listening in, trying to go learn everything and just appreciate what you're doing.
Scott, thank you very much, Scott. We're here every Sunday night at 8 o'clock. The technical net has been around since 1982. And so if you ever have any kind of questions that you want to share and get some other people's opinion, this is a great place to learn all kinds of fun stuff. So I hope you'll stay tuned, Scott, and I hope you'll participate in the future. It's a great hobby. It has an incredible amount of depth and breadth to it. You can treat it as a superficial way of chatting with friends, or you can dive deeply into all kinds of things in this hobby. It is very diverse, from moon bounce and satellite tracking to digital signals, internet networks, all matter of things, mesh networks. The list goes on and on. So I'm sure you'll enjoy this hobby.
Thank you very much. I'm sure I will be.
Okay, once again, this is Roy, Alpha Charlie 2, Golf Sierra, AC2GS. And here with the technical net, if anyone has any technical questions tonight, eventually we'll go to the science net, or as I'm unfortunately tend to name it, the virus net. But please, if people don't want to hear anything about the virus, you can either tune in later or do something else. You know, unfortunately, some people are very concerned and want to know more things, and other people aren't. That's certainly understandable, but you can't do both simultaneously. But before then, I just want to give everyone the opportunity to chat about radio technology on a radio technical net. So if anyone has any questions of a technical nature and would like to ask them, or a topic or a comment, please give me your first name and your call sign. Okay, I guess we'll move on to the science talk. The first story I kind of pushed up because someone was interested in the subject, and so I take suggestions, and so I pushed it up to the top. So I'll let it drop for a second, and then I'll go on to the first story. Did I hear something in the background? Okay, I'll assume not. Scientists in Massachusetts, Italy, and elsewhere are experimenting with a familiar medical treatment for the new problem of COVID-19. They have begun clinical trials meant to find out whether inhaled nitric oxide can save people who are severely sick from the new coronavirus. This treatment might even be used preventively to keep healthcare workers infection-free. Nitric oxide, or NO, is a key part of our biology and is not to be confused with nitrous oxide, that's N2O or laughing gas. It helps our blood vessels dilate, speeding up blood and oxygen flow around the body. For decades, nitric oxide has also been repurposed by doctors to relieve blood pressure in pulmonary arteries of oxygen-deprived patients whose lungs have failed. These clotted arteries make it harder for the lungs to process oxygen, even when it's being supplied by a ventilator. This use of nitric oxide was first tested out in blue-faced newborns in the 1990s, becoming an FDA-approved therapy in 1999. It's since been expanded to other groups of patients. About 500,000 Americans have breathed nitric oxide, mainly adults with cardiac surgery and various things, of course. 30,000 babies a year. Warren Zappel, the emeritus anesthesiologist in chief at Massachusetts General Hospital and a professor at Harvard Medical School, told reporters. Many people who contract COVID-19 suffer no more than a bad cold, but severe cases can develop acute respiratory distress syndrome, ARDS, which is a frightening and deadly condition. The lungs of people with ARDS become flooded with leaky body fluid, cutting off their oxygen supply and effectively drowning them. Though intervention like invasive ventilation can save someone from ARDS, it remains a grim prognosis, as septic shock and organ failure often follow. ARDS isn't just risky for COVID-19 patients either. The needed life-saving interventions can expose healthcare workers to concentrated aerosolized dosages of the virus from a patient. Let me drop for a sec. This is primarily first a lung injury. We all know that. But if you don't stop it, it'll get to your heart, your liver, and the rest of your organs and kill you, said Zippel. Nitric oxide is already used as a rescue therapy for ARDS cases where people are unable to get enough oxygen through a ventilator. So Zippel and his colleagues reason that nitric oxide could be used for difficult COVID-19 cases as well. But it's not just the crucial boost to lung function that has Zippel and his colleagues interested in this treatment. Nearly two decades ago, scientists in China found evidence that suggested the gas itself could kill or inhibit the growth of SARS coronavirus in patients, while other scientists found the same pattern in the lab. Because COVID-19 is caused by a coronavirus closely related to SARS, called SARS-CoV-2, they're hoping this same trick will work against it as well. Zipal and colleagues have begun two randomized controlled clinical trials at Massachusetts Hospital. One will involve COVID-19 patients already dealing with severe respiratory distress. The other will involve patients with mild to moderate COVID-19. In both trials, the hope is that nitric oxide can stop things from getting worse. Let me stop for a second. Another trial that they hope to get approved and underway would actually test whether nitric oxide can help protect the medical staff treating these patients. Zipal's team theorized that you can dose healthcare workers with nitric oxide before and after their shifts so that the virus had a harder time infecting them, though they would temporarily have work normally. I hate seeing doctors and nurses becoming COVID-19 positive. I hate it, end quote, Zipal said. So we'll hopefully see if he can prevent healthcare workers from going positive. Any potential treatment for COVID-19, no matter how useful it has been for other conditions, will have to go through the ringer of clinical trials before it should be widely used. But Zipal's team is already working with researchers in Italy and China to test out nitric oxide in patients there as part of a long-standing collaboration between the groups. So if it does work, we will have more than one line of evidence to prove it. Anyway, this is AC2GS, and I'll drop for any questions or comments.
KC2OIS.
Yes, Mark.
Hi, how are you? Thanks for remembering my name. My cousin's husband got the virus. He came to New York to visit his son, and they live in Florida. And they're gonna try giving him some plasma from someone that had the virus and got well. So hopefully that'll be an antibody. So that's what we're all praying for right now. Over to you, Roy.
Yes, I hope it works. It has a history of being beneficial. This is a type of a treatment that was first performed back in the Spanish influenza pandemic of the 1917 to 1920s, and to a degree is effective. It's not without its own risk. You're giving foreign material to a person. Some of them are antibodies that will help protect them from the viral infection, but other antibodies are for different things, that there might be immune reactions. And so it is not a danger-free treatment, but I hope that it works in this case. I hope it works for everyone. They're still working on so many different methods. There'll be stories follow over the next hour or so of the different things that scientists are feverishly trying to invent on the fly. But I wish you relative good luck on it.
Roger that. Thank you so much.
Okay, anyone else with any comments or questions related to that story?
WS2N?
Yes, Paul.
Paul, how's my audio? I had my antenna moved earlier. Am I okay?
Yeah, you're sounding good, Paul.
Yeah, I'll leave it like that for later. Two messages, though. One thing I wanted to say about the nitric oxide, is this a tank common in the hospital? You just roll it up to the patient, let them breathe it for an hour, or is it something they go on for days on end? Would that be the treatment? this something that they would have to take home with them, you know, and you use it intermittently, you know, for 2 weeks, you know. Just wondering what the treatment for something like that would be. And then the second message was last week's mailbag to N2WIN. Jennifer was heard by her. She couldn't get back, couldn't reach the repeater at the time, but did hear that whole answer that you had. Back to you.
Oh, it's good to hear that. I emailed her and asked her if she heard the answer. They don't really have any firm protocols. They're just winging it at this point. They're going to try and experiment with both very seriously ill and not quite so seriously ill, and from there kind of decide on what the parameters will be. If it's found to be effective in the long haul, they may very well give people a tank and have them take a whiff of it every so often. But at this point, everything is very vague. The big question is whether or not it's effective in people with ARDS due to COVID-19, and if it can be in some way preventative. That would be really nice if they can prove that. The problem is that there's a lot left to be proved. There's a lot of very interesting theories, and some of them sound great. But you have to prove them. If you don't prove them and you just kind of go, what the hell, what do you got to lose? Everyone's running around with things that may or may not work, at methods that may or may not work, at times that may or may not work. So as much as I understand that some people can be desperate about these things, it's life and death, you have to kind of make sense of what you're doing before you standardize them. So the bottom line is they haven't really set a proper protocol yet. They have to decide whether there's a inherent efficacy and a low risk first before they can fine-tune it.
Okay, well, at least something's pointing them in the right direction. I hope it works out. Back to you, Roy.
Yes, indeed. Anyone else with any questions or comments about that particular story?
AC2LR.
Yes, Kay.
If someone donates antibodies, will the recipient acquire all the donor's immunity? Like, say, if I was vaccinated against measles, and if I had antibodies, you know, I donated antibodies against having coronavirus, will the person who accepted my donation also be immune to measles?
Well, okay, that gets kind of complicated. The people have kind of the highest amount of antibodies when they've just fought off the infection. So the amount of antibodies for coronavirus will be orders of magnitude higher than the antibodies for other things that we've been vaccinated or been infected with and have an immune response to. Also, antibodies are not long-lived. So these are very good temporary measures to fight off the infection, but they're not the same as, say, a vaccine, where it's going to go away and you could give this to people who never had the virus and they would be immune to it. It doesn't work quite like that. So it's another weapon to use against the virus when it's surging in a body. But it's not going to imbue you with long-term immunities that a proper vaccination would.
Oh, so it almost works like passive immunity from a mother's philosophy. How a mother passes her immunity out to a baby, you would know.
Exactly. That's a perfect analogy to this.
Back to you.
You're welcome, Kay. Anyone else with any questions on this subject, please? Okay, let's go on to the next one. You may have noticed an apparent spike in the COVID-19 death numbers. And some have accused local governments of falsely overcounting the mounting deaths to this pandemic. But it really isn't any local government's health department's fault. You see, the Center for Disease Control and Prevention has changed how it will officially count the number of people sickened and killed by COVID-19 in the United States. This past week, the agency announced it would start including in its tally both confirmed and probable cases and deaths attributed to the novel coronavirus. The decision was made on the recommendation of public health experts, according to the CDC. In early April, the Council of State and Territorial Epidemiologists, a nonprofit organization that represents epidemiologists in the field, issued an interim position statement on how COVID-19 cases and deaths should be defined. They argue that the CDC and all health agencies in the United States should collect and present data on both confirmed and probable cases of the viral disease. They also laid out criteria for how cases should be classified as either confirmed or probable. Any confirmed case of death would require a positive test for the genetic RNA presence of SARS-CoV-2, the coronavirus that causes COVID-19. Someone with a probable cause, a case on the other hand, may not have gotten this test, but would still have at least two symptoms commonly reported with COVID-19, such as fever, chills, dry cough, a loss of smell and taste. In addition to symptoms, though, there would need to be at least one other form of evidence. Let me drop for a sec. A probable case could have had close contact with someone else confirmed or suspected of having COVID-19, recently traveled somewhere with a sustained outbreak, or be part of a high-risk group for catching it, such as healthcare workers. They could have also gotten other lab results that suggest an infection, such as a positive test for antibodies to the virus. Having a suggestive lab test and evidence of exposure would also be enough for probable diagnosis. For a death to be considered probable, meanwhile, the person's death certificate signed by a coroner or other medical practitioner would need to list COVID-19 or the coronavirus as the cause of death or a significant condition contributing to his death. A confirmed COVID-19 death would include the above as well as a positive RNA test result. The CDC now states on its website that both confirmed and probable cases of deaths will be included in its provisional count, abiding to the guidelines set by the above CSTE. With the CSTE's blessing, the CDC also officially classified COVID-19 as a nationally notifiable disease, which requires all state and local health agencies to provide any relevant case data to the CDC. As of April 2020, according to the CDC, there have been 605,390 cases and over 24,000 deaths attributed to the COVID-19 in the U.S. Let me drop for a sec. Cities across the country have reported spikes of people dying at home or in long-term care facilities in recent weeks, many whom have never been tested for COVID-19. Ideally, these changes to the case and death criteria should make it easier to track the size and spread of the local outbreak. New York, for instance, revised its death toll earlier this week. It now has over 10,000 reported deaths, with nearly 4,000 considered probable. Even these revised counts will probably still underrepresent fatalities, though. It's not clear, for instance, just how far back in time health agencies and the CDC will go to count and add probable COVID-19 deaths to the toll. And it's not clear yet if and when all states will adhere to the CSTE's guidelines and how this data will be represented to the public. Johns Hopkins now seems to include the revised death toll from New York. It remains likely that it will take a long time for us to know with any certainty just how many people have actually died of COVID-19 by this pandemic's end. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GS. Okay, let me move on to the next story. Here's a little cautionary tale that demonstrates that even in these days of this horrible pandemic, it's always caveat emptor, let the buyer beware. Two Chinese companies were offering a risky proposition, 2 million home test kits, said to detect antibodies for the coronavirus for at least $20 million. Take it or leave it. The asking price was high, the technology was unproven, and the money had to be paid up front. And the buyer would be required to pick up the crate loads of test kits from a facility in China. Yet British officials took the deal, according to a senior civil servant involved, then confidently promised tests would be available at pharmacies in as little as 2 weeks. Quote, as simple as a pregnancy test, gushed Prime Minister Boris Johnson, it has the potential to be a total game changer. There was one problem, however. The test didn't actually work. Found to be insufficiently accurate by a laboratory at Oxford University, 500,000 of the tests are now gathering dust in storage. Another 1.5 million bought at a similar price from other sources have also gone unused. The fiasco has left embarrassed British officials scrambling to get back at least some of their money. They might perhaps have slightly jumped the gun, said Professor Peter Openshaw of the Imperial College London, a member of the government's new and emerging respiratory virus threat advisory group. There is a huge pressure on politicians to come out and say things that are positive. A spokesperson from the Department of Health and Social Care said that the government had ordered the smallest number of tests allowed by the seller and that it would try to recover the money without specifying quite how. The ill-starred purchases are in some ways a parable of the risks in this escalating scrum among competing governments racing for an edge in the fight against the pandemic. Let me drop for a sec. The still emerging tests for antibodies formed in response to the virus are the next stage in the battle. By enabling public health officials to assess where the disease has spread and who might have some immunity, the widespread use of the test is seen as a critical step in determining how and when to lift the lockdowns currently paralyzing societies and economies in much of the world. Quote, you can't lift the lockdown as long as you are not testing massively, said Nicholas Locker, a professor of virology at the University of Surrey. As long as the government is not testing in the community, we are going to be on lockdown, he said. The gamble on the Chinese antibody test, though, also is a barometer of the desperation British officials felt as public pressure was mounted over their slow response to the virus. One prominent expert, Jeremy Farrar, the head of the Wellcome Trust, a British nonprofit that is a major funder of medical research, recently warned that the United Kingdom is likely to be certainly one of the worst, if not the worst, affected country in Europe. Long before the development of an antibody test, Germany, for example, the continent's leader in containing the virus, began conducting as many as 50,000 diagnostic tests a day to help trace and isolate cases. The rate is now nearly 120,000 a day. As of Wednesday, Britain was still conducting less than 20,000 diagnostic tests a day, having missed the previous target of 25,000 diagnostic tests a day by the middle of April. Officials are now promising to reach 100,000 a day by the end of the month and as much as 250,000 a day soon after that. British officials have said that they have started out behind because they lacked major private testing companies of the sort found in Germany and the United States, which are capable of manufacturing and performing tens of thousands of diagnostic tests. Let me drop for a sec. But by the time Britain began pushing in earnest to expand its capacity, it was also trailing behind most of Europe in the competition to buy up the limited supply of compounds, tubes, and even swabs needed for diagnostic tests to determine a current infection with the virus. So when the Chinese offer of antibody tests arrived, the officials knew that almost every government in the world was hunting for them too. Oil-rich Persian Gulf princes were bidding up the prices. Medical companies in China, where the virus first emerged, seemed to hold all the cards, typically demanding yes or no decisions from buyers with full payment up front in as little as 24 hours. The two Chinese companies offering the antibody test, Alltest Biotech and Wanfo Biotech, both said their products met the health, safety, and environmental standards set by the European Union. Public health officials reviewed the specifications on paper while the British Foreign Ministry hurriedly dispatched diplomats in China to ensure the companies existed and to examine their products. Within days of the deal, enthusiastic health officials back in London were promising that the new tests would vault Britain into the vanguard of international efforts to combat the virus. Appearing on March 25th before a parliamentary committee, Sharon Peacock, a professor of public health and microbiology at Cambridge University, who is the senior public health official overseeing the infectious disease, testified that the test would require only a pinprick in the privacy of one's home and would soon be available at a minimal cost from either local pharmacies or Amazon. Let me drop for a sec. Testing the test is a small matter, Professor Peacock assured lawmakers. I anticipate that it would be done by the end of this week. After quietly admitting last week that the testing had, in fact, proven unsuccessful, health officials are now defending the purchase as a prudent plan and a valuable experience. It was to be expected, Professor Chris Whitty, Britain's chief medical officer, said in the news conference. It would be very surprising if, first out of the gate, we got to the best outcome that we could for this kind of test, he said. It made a lot of sense to get started early. But Greg Clark, the chairman of a parliamentary committee examining the coronavirus response, said that the government's promises appeared unrealistic. Quote, there's no country in the world that is able to operate in massive scale antibody tests yet, he said in an interview. I think it's now clear, he said, that we should have moved earlier and more expansively to make use of all the testing facilities that we could have. After British complaints about the test kit surfaced, both Chinese companies blamed British officials and politicians for misunderstanding or exaggerating the utility of their tests. One foe told Global Times, a Chinese newspaper, that its products were intended only as a supplement for patients who had already tested positive for the virus. Alltest said in a statement on its website that the tests were only used by professionals, not patients at home. Doctors say the government's description of the antibody test could also be rather misleading. By comparing the antibody test to a pregnancy test, officials seem to be suggesting that the antibody test would determine whether a patient was currently infected. But a discernible level of antibodies may not appear in the blood until as long as 20 days after the infection, meaning a person with a virus would test negative until then. Let me drop for a sec. The British military laboratory at Bordentown is also working on an antibody test, but primarily to help public health officials assess the course of the pandemic by surveying samples of the population, not to inform individual patients. The government is hoping to repurpose some of the stored Chinese-made kits for this sort of population-level testing. Do-it-yourself pinprick tests, like the ones the British government ordered from China, are far more complicated and much further off than such laboratory tests, researchers say. It's not yet certain what degree of immunity recovery from a past infection may confer either. Rapid antibody tests have limited utility for patients, the World Health Organization warned in April 8th statement, telling doctors that such tests remain unfit for clinical purposes until they've been proven to be accurate and effective. British officials, though, were eager for a breakthrough. Even in late March, as the pandemic overwhelmed hospitals in Italy and Iran, British officials brushed off the advice of the World Health Organization to expand diagnostic testing as quickly as possible. By the time that Britain began pushing in earnest to expand its testing, every country in the world was competing for the same material. To make up for the shortfall, academic research laboratories have sought to convert themselves into small-scale clinical testing facilities, typically focusing on the needs of local hospitals. Let me drop for a sec. If it comes around from the government, all well and good, said Ravindra Gupta, professor of clinical microbiology at Cambridge University's Department of Medicine. But we have to prepare for nothing to come. It would be crazy to wait, she said. Cancer Research UK, a nonprofit organization, is converting its research laboratories to conduct as many as 2,000 tests a day, but its capacity has been limited to a few hundred because of difficulty and delays in obtaining scarce materials, said Professor Charles Swanton, its chief clinical officer. Even the swabs used to obtain samples had turned out to be scarce, he said. And his laboratory ultimately agreed to pay a Chinese supplier as much as $6 a swab. That's about 100 times the typical cost. It took about 10 days to get them, the professor said. The British division of the drug giant AstraZeneca began setting up a test facility last month for its own essential workers. The executive overseeing the effort said, but at the time of the British government, AstraZeneca and its rival drug company, GlaxoSmithKline, have teamed up to repurpose a laboratory at Cambridge University to carry out as many as 30,000 diagnostic tests a day by the beginning of May. AstraZeneca hopes to develop a laboratory test for antibodies as well, Mr. Pangol said, but that will take time until maybe the middle of next month, and a home-based test such as the British government tried to order would probably take much longer, he added. Everyone is overpromising at the moment, he said, and I don't want to overpromise. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GS. Okay, on to the next story. Countries are not the only things getting fleeced sometimes. It's the desperate people. Federal prosecutors this very week charged a Southern California doctor with selling coronavirus treatments online, including a drug repeatedly promoted by some as 100% cure, officials said. The doctor, Jennings Ryan Staley, 44, a licensed physician and the owner of, quote, Skinny Beach Med Spa in San Diego, was charged with mail fraud on Thursday for his role in selling COVID-19 treatment packs that included the medications hydroxychloroquine and azithromycin. The United States Attorney General Office for the Southern District of California said in a statement. The treatment packs were billed as a concierge medicine experience and retailed for $3,995 for a family of four. That included, among other things, access to Dr. Steele, the two medications, and some anti-anxiety treatment to help you avoid panic if needed and help to get you to sleep, the prosecutor said. Skinny Beach Med Spa, which offers a range of beauty-related services such as Botox, hair removal, and fat transfer, started advertising the packs in the late March time frame, prosecutors said, and the investigation was opened by the FBI agent receiving a tip. In a phone call with an undercover FBI agent, according to court records, Dr. Steele said that he was selling anti-malarial medication that, quote, cures the disease, end quote, and identified the medication as hydroxychloroquine. It's preventative and curative, Dr. Steele said, according to the prosecutors. It's hard to believe, it's almost too good to be true, but it's a remarkable clinical phenomenon, he said. During the phone call, they noted, he also mentioned another anti-malarial drug, mefloquine, and he said that he would sell that to the undercover agent if he ran out of the hydroxychloroquine. Dr. Staley, according to prosecutors, said that both drugs would totally cure COVID-19, the disease caused by the new coronavirus, and that taking the treatment before getting sick would make one immune for at least 6 weeks. According to prosecutors, Dr. Steele guaranteed that the treatment would cure the virus, though he later seemed to couch his statement, telling the undercover agent, you know, there's no real guarantee in life. There's no guarantees of anything. Let me drop for a sec. When Dr. Steele was interviewed by the FBI the following week, according to prosecutors, he said, it would be foolish to tell patients that the treatments are 100% effective cure for coronavirus. Quote, we will not tolerate COVID-19 fraudsters who try to profit and take advantage of the pandemic fear to cheat, steal, and harm others, end quote, said Robert S. Brewer, Jr., the United States Attorney for the Southern District of California. Rest assured, those who engage in this despicable conduct will find themselves in the crosshairs of federal prosecutors. Patrick Griffin, Dr. Steele's lawyer, said Friday night that his client was following the example of the executive branch of government that is now fairly prosecuting him. The executive branch that has been studying two medications for weeks has now turned around and criminally charged an Iraqi veteran Dr. Staley with no criminal record for doing exactly the same thing that the administration's been doing all the time. Chloroquine, sometimes combined in the with the antibiotic azithromycin, seemed to help patients, but studies were small and did not use proper control groups. Let me drop for a sec. Mr. Griffin said that his client truly believed he was helping people during crisis, adding that the treatment packs were sold at a fair market price. In an email, Mr. Griffin says that Dr. Staley even gave the undercover agents the opposite of scamming anyone, he said. He declined to comment on the claims prosecutors said Dr. Staley made about the medication. The proper forum for this conduct is really more of a state regulatory agency instead of a federal criminal courtroom, his lawyer said. Really, what we have here is a dispute about what a physician feels is in the best interest of his patient. But the case, Assistant U.S. Attorney Robert Hui said, is about 100% curative claims made about this medication. Quote, our case is not about the doctor touting drugs, Mr. Hui said in a phone interview on Friday. It's not about whether drugs are good or bad. It's about him telling would-be customers in an effort to sell his services that he's offering 100% cure and it confers temporary immunity. That, he said, is very different from arguing over the results of a study or precise efficacy of the drug. If convicted, Dr. Staley could face up to 20 years in prison. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GS.
AC2GS, this is KD2TRG.
Yes, what's your first name?
Hi, my name is Bob. I'm in Stony Brook, New York.
Okay, what's your comment, Bob?
Personally, I lived out in California for a while. I got a sister who lives out there, and I've seen more charlatan doctors, per se, than you could shake a stick at out there. And I run enough. Bad doctors get into the healthcare business as far as Botox and skin, types of bizarro things that basically scam people. They don't take any medical insurance, they only take care. And, personally, I think they should take this guy and fry him. Not only false hope, but just. The pure fact of, scamming people at a time of need. Just, I didn't get a chance to comment before on your remark about the Chinese government. Let me drop it here for a sec. Charging the British government the exorbitant fees that they were doing for their stuff, it's like, I'm going to, it's like the guys that invent radar. As bad as this guy is, and this isn't the time to try to scam. They always say politicians are that's too strong scoundrel, but it's starting to turn is going road. KD2, back to you.
Okay, very good, Bob. I think you're over-modulating out of the repeater when you're peaking in your voice. So you might want to try moving the microphone a little bit farther away or dropping the gain a bit. I hate when especially fellow physicians turn, if you will, to the dark side of the force for the easy buck. Grifters, unfortunately, grift. They will grift in good times and bad. There are places in Mexico that will absolutely positively guarantee you that they could cure any cancer known to mankind. And a few of those people actually popped up originally in places like California and Arizona and Texas. And when the legal processes shut them down, they moved to Tijuana and Baja California and other lovely places. So this is an ongoing thing. Cancer cures, again, it's another thing that taps into the desperation of people. And so you have a lot of cancer cures that people are wasting their life savings and not getting proper care, and it's a mess. And in this case, you'll get other terrible, terrible people who will abuse the system and con people. It's a crying shame, and I agree with you. I think they should throw the book at them a couple of dozen times.
Roger that. You know, you guys, you know, that are out there in the medical professional field are, you know, have a calling. And where I live, I have an enormous amount of nurses and doctors that live in my area. I work at Brookhaven National Laboratory, where we're actually on the light source beam. They're trying to work with some of the other laboratories in, you know, coming up with a cure for the COVID-19. I'm not part of Light Source, but I do know they're working very vigilant over there. And, you know, my hopes and thoughts and prayers are with all these guys that are trying to find something out for us. KD2TRG, back to net, and I'll be quick.
WS2N.
Yes, Paul.
What he just said about Brookhaven, if you go to the Newsday site, Newsday is letting people read the information. Newsday has the, you know, you can click on the different topics and they have a whole topic on that. The Light Source building and all the people out there that are working involved with that. They give quite a bit of information on that, so you can read about that. They just say most of the people working at home, and they have a smaller group that are actually there to operate that equipment. Pretty good read, though. Back to you, Dr. Ford.
Okay, very good, Paul. A lot of very fine newspapers are letting people who do not pay subscription fees read their material during this pandemic. The New York Times is doing it. You mentioned a newspaper doing it. And my experience is the Wall Street Journal, for whatever reason, doesn't do that. Very often I get flagged with interesting stories from the Wall Street Journal, and because I don't subscribe to it, I hit a paywall, and that's the end of that. But there's a lot of very good writing out there, and a lot of good information. So I wish all these guys well. These are the giants that we all stand on their shoulders, the pioneers who invent different technology and techniques and work hard for, you know, not that much grant money. So it's not fame and money that's driving these people, but their own internal drives. And these bad situations always kind of demonstrate the best and the worst of humanity. And I like to look on the best and light a really bright flashlight on the worst, so that they'll scamper away and hide under a rock someplace.
Actually, I like to put an ultraviolet light on them so they're dead.
Well, you know, I mean, sometimes the punishment is a wee bit more than the crime. So I don't want to kill anyone. I just would like to have this guy's license taken away, you know, have him sell Roto-Rooter or I don't know what, face cream that doesn't do anything. You know, I mean, there's a lot of places for con artists that don't require a medical degree.
Yeah, well, I don't believe in capital punishment, so I hear you. But I'll tell you one thing. Anybody who thinks this is not brought to you by the People's Liberation Army and the Chinese Communist Party and their arrogance and their disregard for human life and their wanting to save face, if you don't acknowledge that, then we can have a debate about all the other things about how we handle it. That's fine, but there's certain undeniable facts. And by the way, regarding the Wall Street Journal, that's the only... That and The Guardian are how I spend my money on newspapers. I won't buy the Times. I'll have to give it away. WTCDT.
okay. I mean, that's free enterprise. You give your money to the people that you want to support and the businesses that you want to support. And, you know, that's what makes America great. I think the Chinese have a great deal of answers to give humanity. I think they screwed the pooch, if you will, on so many different levels. But unfortunately, we can't just kind of